Saudi Arabia reaches a surprise deal to restore relations with Iran after 7 years of hostility. An analyst with the Middle East Institute explains what is behind China's role in mediating that agreement.
China is the biggest trading partner of every single country in the Middle East. Not one or two, all of them. Nobody can claim the same thing. What does that mean? That means China has leverage.
Plus, a campaign to list Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist group in the EU is stuck as some European officials cite legal obstacles. We'll get reaction from an Iranian-born Belgian lawmaker with a different view.
This is not what all of the ministers of foreign affairs in Europe are thinking. Lots of them are pro putting IRGC on the terror list.
Later in the program, we'll look at why Brazil allowed two Iranian warships to dock in its territory this month over U.S. objections. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran and Saudi Arabia announced a deal on Friday to reestablish diplomatic ties between the longtime Mideast rivals after officials from both sides held several days of previously undisclosed talks in Beijing. In a joint statement issued with China, Iran and Saudi Arabia pledged to reopen embassies in their respective capitals within 2 months. Sunni-majority Saudi Arabia broke off ties in 2016 in response to demonstrators in Shiite-majority Iran storming the Saudi embassy in Tehran. The demonstrators were angry about Riyadh's execution of a prominent Shiite cleric. China's role in mediating the deal caught many observers by surprise. I spoke on the phone to Alex Vitanka of the Middle East Institute and asked what explains the timing of the Chinese-backed agreement.
I think this deal has been kind of in the making for some time. I think you can probably make the argument that for the Saudis, the year 2019 was pivotal. That's the year where they were attacked by Iran. And that's also in the midst of the Trump administration, a American president that the Saudis had high hopes for, the Gulf states in general had high hopes for, wanted to see a more muscular American position in defense of Gulf interests vis-a-vis Iran. And when the United States basically did not do as the Gulf states had hoped for, right or wrong, they realized that actually they were better off not antagonizing the Iranians because they were on their own. So we've seen in the last few years a shift in the so-called diversification of Gulf policies. They needed to come together. They needed to stop attacking each other. They deepened relations with China. They decided to have a dialogue with the Russians and did not choose to side with the West in the Ukraine war. And finally, while they didn't sort of walk away from Israel or walk away from any of their deals with the United States, they're still partners as far as military cooperation is concerned and so on. But at the end of the day, they realized that they also needed to hedge, if you will, when it came to Iran. And I think that's what you've seen with this diplomatic arrangement, that in many ways, the most surprising part of that development is China's role.
Well, I was actually just going to ask you about Chinese mediation. Given that you said Saudi had multiple reasons to want to hedge and do a deal with Iran, how important was Chinese mediation? I mean, was that a major factor here?
It's a major factor. I don't think it's the end of American presence in the Middle East. I think, frankly, at this moment, if America's presence ends in the Middle East, it's because of American choice. It's not because America is going to be pushed out by China or anybody else. America might decide that Middle East is not worth its resources, blood and treasure, and it wants to focus on China, which it sees as a big threat. Nothing in the Middle East really threatens national security interests of the United States the way China could do in the near future. So that's America's choice. That's what politicians in this country are being paid the big bucks to decide. But in terms of China, look, China is the biggest trading partner of every single country in the Middle East. Not one or two, all of them. From Israel to Iran to Saudi Arabia, nobody can claim the same thing. What does that mean? That means China has leverage. And what does that mean in context of Saudi policies today? Saudi Arabia is clearly a country right now at this moment very much determined to do nation building at home, diversify their economy, bring their youth into an employment sector and all the rest of it. What does that mean? That means they need foreign investment. They need stability. China is a key trading partner, gets about 15% of its oil from Saudi Arabia. It's a major investor potentially. And what does Iran have to do with this? Well, Iran being a spoiler next door with its growing missile and drone capabilities is not exactly going to bring about foreign investor confidence, or in general is going to weaken interest in the Saudi economy and market. The Abqaiq attack of 2019 showed the Iranians can attack any strategic target they want anywhere in their neighborhood. You don't want to send that as part of your PowerPoints to foreign investors. So what the Saudis are doing right now with talking to the Iranians, that doesn't mean all their problems are going to be solved. At the very maximum in terms of hope is that Iran can be part of a dialogue to end the Yemen war, which is something the Saudis desperately want to end because it's a drain on their coffers. Again, it hurts confidence in their economy. It distracts in terms of economic development. That's the maximum hope you have in Saudi Arabia. The minimum hope is, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't become a target for Iranian retaliation should there be a conflict at some point in the future between, say, U.S., Israel, and Iran.
The Biden administration has responded by saying it supports dialogue and diplomacy to de-escalate tensions and prevent conflict, and it would seem that Iran and Saudi both want that as well. So what are the pros and cons of this deal for the U.S.?
Look, I mean, in terms of the optics here, people can say this is the end of American influence in the region. Vastly exaggerated. This has been said before. If America decides to leave the region, that might be something that to worry about. But again, that's an American decision. The Chinese have a lot of economic leverage, yes, but they're not a security guarantor for any of these states in the Gulf and elsewhere. So it's going to be very hard for China in the short term to replace the United States. But again, symbolism matters. Optics do matter. If you have an image of a decline in global power, then that might have ramifications elsewhere. But right now, I think what China has achieved should not be underestimated. But how much more can China build on this remains to be seen. And, you know, frankly, on this particular issue, the Chinese were well placed to be a mediator. And the United States couldn't, because the United States doesn't have relations with Iran, doesn't have any leverage over Iran. And that is a reflection of American limitations and shortcomings in terms of its diplomatic capabilities. But that's not Washington's choice. That's Iran's choice. It's the Iranian side that doesn't talk to the United States.
Well, Alex Vitanka, director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute, speaking to us from here in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for joining us again on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Michael.
It has been almost 2 months since activists campaigning for the European Union to designate Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization ran into an apparent legal roadblock. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said in January the 27-nation bloc cannot take such an action against Iran's top military force until an EU court first rules on the matter. The EU Parliament responded by voting to urge the EU's executive branch to take the action anyway. One European politician supporting that campaign is Iranian-born member of Belgium's parliament, Daria Safai. I spoke to her at an Iranian opposition event in Washington on Monday and asked what she has been doing to make progress on the issue.
Very important to know that since the revolution of Mahsa Amini, we have working on it. Even I have given a resolution in Belgian parliament to put IRGC on the terror list of Europe. And also, we have made a very big and just a huge manifestation of people, Iranian and European people, in front of the European Parliament to let them hear how important it is to put IRGC on this terror list. The importance is not only symbolic. It's very important to know that IRGC organized terror in the whole region, support proxy wars in the whole region, give the financial possibility to those terrorist groups to fight against Europe and Western countries. So this is how we can weaken Islamic Republic ideology and regime with putting this IRGC on the terror list where it belongs to.
You mentioned there was a resolution that you proposed in the Belgian parliament.
Yes.
What would that resolution do? How does that resolution move forward this objective of getting the designation?
Actually, a resolution is not something that should have been done. But when the majority of the people of a resolution, which is accepted, ask the government to do something, even though they are not obliged, they should do it in one or other form of it, because it's what the democracy demands them. The most of the people, majority of the people, ask them. But let's go back to the European Parliament, which has accepted with the majority to put IRGC on the terror list in Europe. And that is because even in the speech of the president of European Parliament was obvious that she told the Iranian people, listen, you are on the good side of the history and we are with you and we support you. This is what I would like to see and hear from European politicians and the people who has power in Europe, because recognizing that the Iranian revolution, it's not only about Iran and the future of Iran. It changed the whole policy in the whole world toward peace, toward freedom and prosperity. This is important for the European politicians to know.
Well, as you were saying in your remarks here at the NFT event, there's a lot of sympathy in European governments for putting more pressure on the Iranian government, giving more support to the Iranian people. But you have the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, saying a few months ago, there's a legal problem. We need a court to rule on the status of the IRGC before we can do anything. And some EU legal experts have also been saying, well, we don't think there's really a legal basis to do this. How do you overcome that obstacle?
That is obviously just an excuse like others. There is no politic will to make it happen, with Josep Borrell at least. But I should also emphasize that this is not what all of the ministers of foreign affairs in Europe, they are thinking about. Also, a lot of them are pro putting IRGC on the terror list. And they are discussing a problem and they will find a solution for it. But I am sure if we continue to show the right direction, they will follow it. Of course, this is an excuse to have a legal base for putting this terrorist organization on the terror list.
I mean, do you think there really needs to be a legal ruling, or are you saying there doesn't have to be?
It doesn't have to be. It is not necessary. Like Russia, when an aggressor shows itself aggressive, it is not necessary for you to decide on the basis of one or other condemnation of the court. But I will explain you something. Even if they won the condemnation, who has organized the terror attack of 2018 in Paris with the diplomat of the Islamic Republic of
Iran? Talking about Asahi.
Asadullah Asadi.
Asadi, yes.
Who is condemned by a court of a European country, Belgium, to 20 years of prison. So isn't it a legal base for it? But I will guarantee you it's not even necessary. And I will guarantee you this is not finished yet. There are a lot of hope. There are a lot of foreign ministers of the foreign countries who knows about how dangerous IRGC and Islamic Republic regime is for the whole world. And they will continue, and we will continue to fight for the victory of Iranian people.
One of the main themes of today's event here at NFTI was maximum support for the Iranian people, and a whole list of different types of actions that NFTI is proposing to adopt. Which of these kinds of actions do you think are most realistic to come from European governments, like from Belgium or just the EU as a whole?
Actually, all of it can be realistic. They are just the political will and wish to make it happen. And I think we are going the way in this direction. For example, in Iran, the people need money for going on striking. They have tried it for several times, but actually they don't have any social security sources, so they should also go back to work after a while. But imagine that the assets, the frozen assets of Islamic Republic in the world, in the Western countries, can be released and can be sent to those people, then we can just paralyze the economy of Islamic Republic.
But how do you do that in Belgium, for example? How do you do that in the EU? Practically,
actually, this is the decision of the government who should decide to release it and find a way, and we can help it to find a way to Iran itself. This is also not a big issue to find the channels to find the way to them. And also, internet is very important because Islamic Republic is afraid of those films and pictures who goes out of the country and they cut the internet. So being in contact with the world is just the only way that Iranian people can be protected and continue their revolution. We should also provide that one.
What specifically could, you know, European Union members do to improve the, you know, communication ability of the people in Iran?
Investing in a lot of things like buying the satellites of how do we call it?
Starlink.
Starlink, to send it to Iran, because one of them is enough for a big region. So if you can just find a way to do that, and I think they should do it, because if you are for freedom of speech and if you are for a future, democratic future for Iran, then we should also play our own role. And this is important, to never let their voice be silenced. This is a way.
Well, Daria Safai, member of the Belgian Parliament, speaking to us here at the Hay Adams Hotel in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
With pleasure.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The U.S. State Department has criticized Brazil's decision to let two Iranian warships dock in the port of Rio de Janeiro at the end of February. In a statement to VOA, it said hosting the warships, sanctioned by the U.S. for involvement in illicit activities, was a wrong decision. But the Biden administration also called Brazil a partner that makes such decisions for itself. Emmanuel Ottolenghi is an analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I asked him on the phone why Iran now appears to be trying to get the warships back home via the Panama Canal.
There are a number of goals, I think. One is it's just a show of strength and also of capability, right? We're here. We're able to be here. Nobody can stop us from being here. And we have the skills, the means to engage in this type of activity. So that's, I think, the first point. The second point is, of course, to say we have had you around in our neighborhood for many, many years, and now we can do the same to you. We can come across the ocean. We're no longer just a regional power. Our blue water capability is expanding, and we will be able to deploy forces at sea, even as far as the Western Hemisphere, both sides, if they cross the Panama Canal. And also, last but not least, of course, these trips involve an element of diplomacy, of establishing, developing relations that go beyond the diplomatic dimension, but also touch upon their military-to-military opportunities for encounters, dialogue, and potential exploring cooperation, sharing best practices, learning from other forces, foreign forces, and their experience. And so there is that component too. But I think the biggest element of this journey, the headline, is we're here. We're here and we're welcome here.
Well, you mentioned that Iran may want to try to learn from other countries, you know, naval capabilities. Do we have any idea if the Iranian warships and the personnel on them engaged in any kind of joint training or learning with the Brazilians while they were docked off the coast of Rio?
We do not know that, and it's unlikely that it went that far, but we do know that there were bilateral meetings on board the ships. There was a reception, there were contacts, and The ships were docked there for a week, during which time I'm sure the crews were able to mingle, to come to shore, to meet counterparts. So there was clearly interaction involved. And it's just the beginning, because clearly the visit was authorized by the Brazilian government. And so the possibility for future encounters, for future trips is there. And it is part of a broader attempt by Iran to re-engage with Brazil under the new President Lula, who during his first mandate as president in the earlier part of the century was very much favorable to a broad and deep relationship with the Iranian regime. So there is opportunity there to expand.
Why would Brazilian President Lula make an effort so early in his new term to host these Iranian warships? How does it benefit him at this time, and how does it benefit Brazil to do that?
Well, there is a lot of potential for bilateral commerce between Iran and Brazil. And there is also a worldview that both countries to some extent share. These are two countries that aspire to being global powers. They do not fully embrace the post-World War II order, you know, especially at the UN with the five permanent members, the superpowers that emerged from World War II. And also there is a shared vision of the need for emerging powers from the south of the world to assert themselves and become more influential on the global stage. And I think there is also a recognition by Brazil under this president that U.S. influence is waning in the region. There are new players. Iran is perhaps not the first that comes to mind, but clearly China and Russia are big players trying to penetrate the continent, the southern part of the continent, and to establish influence in the Western Hemisphere, south of the Rio Grande. And Lula intends to play on all tables. He's not aligned with the West in this regard. And so sensing perhaps the weakness of the United States and the ability to chart his own independent course on foreign policy is very important. You know, clearly there is an element of nationalism, or if you wish, of left-wing populism in saying, you know, we don't take orders from Washington. We are a powerhouse, and justifiably so. Brazil is the largest country in the southern hemisphere, you know, in the western hemisphere, south of the Rio Grande, population that far exceeds 200 million people, a large economy with a lot of potential to expand. And of course, he wants to keep all of his options open. And also bear in mind, Brazil is not just a large economy, but there is an important agricultural industrial sector that produces important products for export, meat being one of them, but also, you know, a variety of important crops. It depends on import of fertilizers, which can come from Iran, and they have been coming from Russia. So there is a certain dependency on those countries for the sustainability of Brazil's agro-industrial sector. So it is a relationship that Lula wishes to strengthen. And last but not least, and again, you know, going back to Lula's first term as president, Lula also has ambitions to play a role on the global stage. He tried to mediate between Iran and Western powers during the early stages of the nuclear crisis. It was an unsuccessful attempt. It was not entirely welcome by the United States back in 2009-2010. Be that as may, it's all important background to understand what Lula aspires to do.
Emmanuel Ottolenghi, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, speaking to us from the Greater Washington area. Nice to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
That's a wrap of our program. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for joining us, and I invite you to do the same next week for another Flashpoint Iran.